Welcome back to the IPA's Day of Payments, and it is my pleasure to announce that we have Judy Reinierson and her team from K&L Gates. Judy has been associated, a part of, led, advised the association in many different capacities since back in 2006. She continues to have her ear to the ground. I am very pleased to have her with us this afternoon. And please, if you have questions, feel free to ask this great team that she's put together either during today's presentation or afterwards. You can just email us directly and we'll pass along your thoughts to Judy. But with that, Judy, please take the floor.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you to the Innovative Payments Association. We're delighted to be here. And as you can see, we're focusing on what some are calling the killer crypto app. And I want to make it clear, we're not talking that non-stablecoin, non-CBDC tokens and cryptocurrencies are you know, not successful or not good, but we're recognizing the fact that a lot of the mass acceptance of virtual currencies hasn't occurred yet. A lot of people, mainstream America, are very anxious about virtual currencies and cryptocurrencies. And what is exciting about this development, and it's been going on for quite a while, but it's really, in my view, finally coming to a head, is the concept of a virtual currency or cryptocurrency or digital asset, whatever you want to call it, that actually has some associated value tied to it so that it doesn't at least feel too risky, and it seems to many of mainstream America to be a more secure and easy way to approach these new payment products. So next slide, Stephanie. So I'm gonna make this a quick overview of our agenda. I'm introducing our speakers, then we're gonna look first at stablecoins and Facebook Libra, then we're gonna go to CBDCs. Jeremy McLaughlin, who's a partner in our San Francisco office, is going to walk us through stablecoins. Dan Cohen, who's an associate in our DC office, is going to take us through CBDCs. And then we have the opportunity to hear from Ken Nakamura from GMO, the Japanese internet company, who's going to talk us through their initiative in the stablecoin space. And then we're going to have some time for some Q's and A's. We'll be, I understand, using the chat function. You can submit questions. We're going to hold off until the end of our presentations, and we're hoping to have at least 10 minutes or so at the end for to address your questions. So next slide. So what I wanted to talk about to set the stage are sort of three overriding themes that is sort of facing the payments industry today. And the first is this, I love this quote from Chris Giancarlo about the payments, how do I do this? The payments infrastructure. This is from his testimony before Congress. And he noted that our financial system, which has at one time state of the art, has started to fall behind the times, and in some cases, he says, embarrassingly so. And this is characterized by relying on older traditional methods of payments to settle payments, whether or settle closing and securities or transactions. Everything is very much delayed. And when you compare to what's happening in other parts of the world, it's noticeable. And of course, the most recent reminder of this problem with our payment system is when the US government tried to get out the COVID-19 relief checks, payments by check. And we have so many people who don't have checking accounts. And it took for some people months to get their payments. And this, it shouldn't be happening anymore. And I think people, and this is regulators, legislators, and the industry are coming to grips with the fact that we need to just as we need to fix other parts of our infrastructure, whether it's roads and bridges, we need to look at our financial infrastructure. Next slide. So I think, yes, a lot of you all who have heard me speak before, I'm a big proponent of the blockchain. And I do think that it is, you know, it is going to provide the rails, the same sort of rails that the internet provided that allowed us to move data, share information very effectively, and change, let's face it, it changed everything as we know it. It's a huge change. Well, the blockchain is similar to rails, but as we talk about blockchain or the distributed ledger technology, moving value, not just information. And the difference, of course, is that you don't need a trusted centralized institution, but you can do it with a decentralized network of computational algorithms and, of course, collaborative cryptography to make it all work together. This enables much faster, many cases, instantaneous P2P transfers of not just, you know, value, but, you know, other indicia of value, such as shares of stock and titles. And of course, being a lawyer, I do want to remind everyone that when we look at the role of distributed ledger technology and blockchain, especially in financial services, it's got to have still appropriate global regulation and, of course, very dependable technology. But we're seeing that coming around. FATF put out AML regulations. We are seeing more and more. The OCC has come out saying that banks can now hold the digital assets. We are seeing that the world is starting to coalesce and realize that this is the future. So our next slide, Stephanie. So my last slide is the concept of financial inclusion. And we've all come to recognize that the current, more traditional methods of financial services don't include everyone. There are so many Americans, you see 1 billion people globally, 14 million Americans that lack bank accounts, characterized by the delays in the COVID-19 payments, and that tokenized value, and it doesn't have to be a CBDC, it can easily be a stable coin, and it can be regular cryptocurrency. But these values can provide solutions that don't require access to a bank account and can move money quickly and securely and safely and track it. And so since I quoted Chris Giancarlo, who was behind the Digital Dollar Project, by the way, a former CFTC regulator, I threw in a quote by Mark Zuckerberg, who reminded folks that Libra, as a stable coin, is also going to provide access to financial systems to help people pull people out of poverty. And again, women and developing countries around the world. We think that this is going to create a massive change for payments and for the underbanked and underserved. So with this laying the groundwork, I'm going to pass over the wand, the speaking role, to my colleague, Jeremy McLaughlin, from our San Francisco office, who's going to talk about stablecoins generally and also Libra.
Thanks, Judy. Next slide, please. I've lost the slides. Are others seeing them?
I don't see the, Stephanie, we don't see the slides anymore.
Just one second, switching the deck.
Sure. Well, I can get started as Stephanie works on that. So the earlier today, there was a good panel that did a great job on covering cryptocurrencies in general. So I'm going to speak, as Judy said, about one particular class of stablecoins.
That's not the right slide. I think it came right after my slide. We sent them in a package. Yesterday, day before yesterday.
There we go.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about stablecoins. What are they? How are they regulated? And how can they be used? So there's not yet a universal definition of stablecoins, but it usually has the key attributes that I've listed here. So it's a type of crypto asset that attempts to provide a stable value relative to some other specific asset or pool of assets, such as fiat or other crypto. So basically, it's a cryptocurrency that is pegged to either a fiat currency, such as the US dollar or the euro, or a cryptocurrency or some kind of government-backed security like a bond. And the idea is that there's more stability, hence the name stablecoin, and less volatility from that than something like Bitcoin, which isn't pegged to anything and whose value can fluctuate depending on demand. So this will, in theory, make a stablecoin easier to use for something like payments, because its value won't go up and down drastically during the course of the day or the course of a week. It's intended to have a fixed value. And so a stablecoin can be created in a number of ways. So the kind of easiest example is something like the USD coin, which is pegged to the dollar. So for every USD coin, there's $1 held in reserve. So you have 100 USD coins, and then there's $100 in reserve backing those stablecoins. Another option that is kind of more on the cutting edge, and I've seen a few of these, but it's not as prominent, is the use of kind of an algorithmic process. So for example, there's an algorithm that monitors the performance of a coin in the market. And as the price of the coin starts to fall, the system would pull them in to reduce supply and thus increase the price of the coin. And vice versa, as the price rises, they would put more into the system and reduce the price to keep it at the stable value. So that's stable coins is general. And now the question is, does Libra fit into that? Is Libra a stable coin? And the answer is, in my opinion, kind of sort of. On the one hand, it has indicia of a stable coin because it's pegged to something. Unlike Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, Libra is pegged to something. But the dispute comes up in the specifics as to what it's pegged to. So unlike most other stable coins, Libra, at least as initially introduced, isn't pegged to one specific currency. It's pegged to a group of low volatility assets, including bank deposits and government securities in multiple currencies. So that's the key there. So it won't consistently be worth $1 or 1 euro or 1 anything else. So while on the one hand, Libra is an asset-backed cryptocurrency similar to other stable coins, unlike other stable coins, it's not pegged to just one singular currency. And so it doesn't have one fixed value and one fixed real world currency. The plan and structure of Libra is kind of in a state of flux, largely because of the pushback that Libra has gotten from regulators. So in an updated white paper earlier this year, Libra appeared to scale back its ambition, saying that it would first create a series of single currency stable coins instead. That's not to say that its initial plan of a multi-currency coin is dead. I think it's still in the works. It's just a matter of navigating kind of the regulatory gauntlet in front of it. So next slide, please. So as a lawyer, of course, I have to talk a little bit about how stable coins are regulated. As crypto has proliferated, of course, it's come under regulation from all different levels and angles as people kind of figure out what it is. And I won't go into a ton of detail on all these, especially because some of them were discussed earlier. But I wanted to highlight some levels, especially where stable coins in particular are regulated. Because all of these, the state, federal, and international, kind of just regulate crypto in general, but there have been some developments specific to stable coins. So at the state level, state regulation of crypto covers a variety of topics, including abandoned property and taxes. But our focus here is on stable coins and crypto as a medium of exchange. So the biggest area there is obviously money transmission. And not surprisingly, there is not uniformity among the states about whether and how their money transmitter law applies to crypto. And in fact, most of the guidance and legislation that has come out of states came out before kind of stablecoins really proliferated. So a lot of the states haven't commented specifically on how they would regulate stablecoin. But there are two recent developments that do, so they're interesting to look at. So Louisiana recently enacted a standalone law, the first state actually to pass a full statute specifically to regulating cryptocurrency. It's very similar to the BitLicense regime, so I'm not going to go into the details of all of it, but it essentially requires a license to engage in virtual currency business activity, and that's defined as exchanging, I'm sorry for the construction noise outside, of course they started today. So that's defined as exchanging, transferring, or storing virtual currency, or engaging in virtual currency administration. And that latter phrase is defined as issuing virtual currency with the authority to redeem the currency for legal tender, bank credit, or other virtual currency. So there, I think, is a good example of a very new statute that was signed earlier this year and took effect on August 1st, where they seem to allude specifically to the regulation of stablecoin. Texas is another interesting example at the state level. It had originally issued guidance concluding that crypto-only transactions were not covered by its money transmitter law, but it recently revised that guidance, specifically noting of the widespread introduction of stablecoins. And it said that even though many cryptocurrencies were not regulated in Texas, stablecoins did constitute money or monetary value if that stablecoin gave the holder a redemption right against fiat currency. And so in that case, Texas concluded that stablecoins would be regulated, unlike other cryptocurrencies. So those are some examples at the state level. The federal level, in this Congress, there have been over 30 bills introduced relating to blockchain in some form. But stablecoins is where we see the most activity. Many of them are aimed directly at Libra and focusing on kind of the money laundering implications. Two kind of examples to give you a flavor of the bills, and they're very specifically titled. So the first one, Keep Big Tech Out of Finance Act. So in case you can't figure out what that is, aims to do, it would prohibit large tech companies from establishing, maintaining, or operating digital assets as a medium of exchange. And then another pending bill is the Manage Stablecoins Our Securities Act. And so that essentially would establish and cement that managed stablecoins are a type of security for regulatory purposes. There's also agency level action. I'll just hit on one issue here, that the OCC, that we've seen a lot of action by the acting comptroller, and he recently had an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, seeking comments on the digital banking activities. And that the comment period recently ended, but some of the comments did address stablecoins, but a lot of them pointed to stablecoins as a more efficient way for banks to send money between each other and between client accounts, and so urged the OCC to allow banks to settle payments and accept deposits in stablecoins that met certain criteria as defined by the OCC. And then finally, the international and intergovernmental level. There are kind of two developments on stablecoins here. The Financial Stability Board, the G20 asked the FSB to examine regulatory issues posed by stablecoins and issue some recommendations. And so in April of this year, the FSB issued its consultative document that kind of gave 10 high-level recommendations that sought to balance the potential risk posed by stablecoins, but still support innovation in the area and provide flexibility to national governments as they sought to regulate them. And the Financial Action Task Force, a little over a month ago, issued their own report on stablecoins. It kind of hit three general topics. The definition of stablecoins, which largely mirrored the FSB's, the particular risk posed by stablecoins, especially for anti-money laundering purposes, and then the application of FATF standards to stablecoins. Next slide, please. So then I'll quickly hit on some use cases. Ken is going to get into a broader discussion of a great use case of this later, so I won't take up too much time, but here are some areas where we see potential for stablecoins. For e-commerce, the key benefit of a stablecoin is the ease of onboarding and lower transaction fees, especially compared to credit cards. And it benefiting both the merchants and consumers. So we've seen, for instance, a network of merchants in Southeast Asia really adopt stablecoins to allow for the payment online of purchases ranging from groceries to hotel bookings. remittances for similar reasons as used in e-commerce. We know that kind of crypto assets are already in this space with the use of XRP, Ripple's XRP, and have demonstrated kind of the viability of crypto in this space, especially for lowering fees. And I think the thought is stablecoins will help lower fees even more because of the inherent price stability. Escrow, stablecoins, I think here can make the process of escrow, you know, you can have escrow be completely automated through the use of a smart contract that programmatically evaluates the escrow conditions without the need of an intermediary. And then the benefit of a stablecoin here is that the use of a stablecoin in that escrow provides stability, which, you know, if there's a especially large escrow holding, it could suffer significant losses if whatever we're holding in the smart contract were very volatile. So a stablecoin provides an answer to that. And then finally, I think there's a question about whether, because stablecoins are stable, whether people will start to view them more and more as a store of value as compared to other cryptocurrencies. And so with that, I will now turn it over to my colleague, Dan, who's going to talk about CBDCs.
Thanks, Jeremy. I appreciate it. I think it's just the next slide on the same PowerPoint deck. So we'll give that a second to transfer over.
Hi, Dan. That was the last slide on this deck.
We had sent over some additional slides. It's all right if we...
Why don't you get started and I will get those up.
Yeah, that's fine.
Can you find those, Stephanie? I did send them out to you.
Okay, let me just double check.
Okay.
Yeah, no worries. Happy to start without it. So like stablecoins, central bank digital currencies are more or less what they sound like. They are a digitized version of a central bank liability. So essentially, paper currency and deposits held in the Federal Reserve banks here in the United States are central bank liabilities because they're issued by the central bank for payments. A CBDC, or the digital dollar in the US context, would be a digitized, tokenized version of, you know, the US dollar. It could be used for similar use cases that Jeremy discussed, e-commerce, and ultimately settlement, at the back end at the Federal Reserve level in the United States, or just at the central bank level in other countries. Features of a CBDC are very similar in a legal and cultural context as existing paper or existing commercial bank currency. So you would have full faith and credit from the Fed. You would have the ability for it to be legal tender, to be used in payment and settlements of debts. But technologically, you could see a very different portfolio. For instance, you could have a blockchain or other type of distributed ledger technology-based token. So you'd be using cryptography, you'd be using distributed computing power. And even within that, you could see, you know, various types of consensus protocols used. So you could have something as secure but energy intensive as proof of work, like Bitcoin. You could have something like proof of stake, which many new cryptocurrencies are moving to, as it's less energy intensive and arguably more secure or easier to avoid attacks. Or you could just go for a centralized platform, for instance, what China is doing with its DECP, and really just have one digitized ledger controlled by the central bank with the token issued directly by the central bank to retail accounts, digital accounts, if you wanted. Or you could create the existing two-tier system of money creation here in the United States of central bank money flowing down into commercial bank money flowing down into retail. So how a CBDC can be designed is similar to cryptocurrencies in the sense of there are a lot of options. Depends on your technological preferences, on your policy preferences. For instance, you could build in privacy features or you could build in limitations on how a currency is spent. For instance, the card networks have built-in codes to prevent or block transactions from certain users at certain locations or certain goods. There is some concern that more authoritarian regimes would build a CBDC that would block certain types of transactions, in particular transactions across border to prevent capital outflows. But conversely, in the United States, there would be call for a broader set of technological features to allow more openness. I also want to touch on something that Jeremy discussed, kind of the use of smart contracts, making a central bank digital currency programmable. One of the big features or potential features of a CBDC is the ability to combine the token itself, not just as money, but as part of more complex financial transactions. So for instance, you could have a CBDC that would interact with an oracle to automatically execute payments or settling of certain financial transactions based on real world data. And this could be used in the securities context, the commodities context, derivatives, for instance. So you could create a whole range of transactions that would automatically settle just using one digital token and transferring on the same blockchain, not just value in the form of currency, but value in the form of ownership or title to financial product or some other type of product. There are several examples. Central bank digital currencies have been studied and are being studied for the last several years. I think the rise of stablecoins has accelerated the need for central banks and kind of the concern among central banks to do more. Certainly the concept of Libra, and I call it a concept because it doesn't exist. No one yet can buy Libra, so it's not exactly a stablecoin or whatever form it will ultimately take. But just the mere white paper and the willingness of major international organizations to join forces to create it has really spurred a lot of central banks into testing their own CBDCs to provide many of the same benefits. So for instance, I mentioned in China, China is probably the leader in this field. They've been piloting and testing their digital yuan or renminbi for a long time. Currently there is both retail and industrial B2B payment transfers and pilot testing going on in Chengdu and other cities. There's some discussion apparently of moving the pilot into Hong Kong, though that may not be confirmed as of yet. Sweden is currently in its pilot program for the e-krona. Sweden is one of the most cashless societies in the nation, I think only in the world. I think only 1% of all liabilities are really held in cash. So that's a pretty natural transition for them, but they are piloting through February of 2021. South Korea is another currently engaged in a 22-month pilot. And the United States, which we'll talk about in a bit, has also revealed it is about to start exploring what they call a hypothetical CBDC to be used as a complement for other payments. So with that, if we can go to the next slide. So what are the key differences between a CBDC and a cryptocurrency, you know, including a stable coin? And there are a variety of many others we can talk about, but some of the key ones that come to mind, I think, are the identity of the issuer, who the validators are, what's the consensus protocol, or how do you confirm a transaction so we know who the counterparties are and that they actually have the value to exchange? What's the technological architecture, and how is supply maintained? So first, with issuer, a central bank digital currency is, of course, issued by a central bank. That is very different than most cryptocurrencies, which are issued by private entities. Even within cryptocurrencies, you see, you know, quite a spread. You have some private companies issuing their own digital currencies for their own internal use. For instance, JP Morgan has been experimenting with a JP Morgan coin for institutional investor use for large-scale transfers. Or you see nonprofits come together and issue a coin, or companies issue a coin that's actually open source. For instance, that's what Ripple has done. That's what the Electric Cash Company has done with Zcash. So you have a company who issued the coin, but the coin itself exists open source. Anyone can use it. We'll get into permissions in a second. Or you see just a group of people, like in Bitcoin, coming together, creating the technology, and being part of the network that forms a transaction. So you have a very different set of controls when you have a centralized issuer that is a government entity in a CBDC rather than a private issuer with no real legal obligations for the issuance of the coin. Second validators, or, you know, there's a lot of ways to consider this question, centralized versus decentralized, permission versus permissionless. But in a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, for instance, you have a permissionless network. Anyone can join the network. Anyone can download the Bitcoin software, become a node and help confirm transactions and be part of the settlement system. On a CBDC, it remains to be seen and depends on the existing infrastructure in that country. But you're not going to see a open permissionless system where anyone is going to help ensure that transactions of the US dollar are confirmed. Many are calling, including Christian Carlo, for the US to have a two-tier, like the two-tier existing system, where the Fed would issue a digital dollar as, you know, the central bank currency and let that flow down to commercial banks, to flow down to end users. And commercial banks would play a role in helping to validate transactions. You could also see just a central bank being the sole node validating all transactions and even potentially cut out the existing two-tier system by having direct digital wallets and having transactions straight from the central bank to the retail account. But again, that depends on the underlying system and political preference. I'll move a little more quickly as I see my time is running out. Consensus protocol, most cryptocurrencies use what's called proof of work, which is a laborious computation-based system for proving transactions. This is what Bitcoin uses. Many are shifting to proof of stake, which is a system in which the folks with the most holdings of that particular currency are trusted to confirm transactions because they have a significant stake. That's unlikely to be used, I would think, in a CBDC. People don't really want private actors, to some extent, having how much computing power or how much money they have in the system being the determinant of how the system works. So you're much more likely to see a low carbon intensive, more low fault line system in place, maybe something closer to what Ripple has. And that builds into architecture as well. CBDC does not have to be blockchain or even distributed ledger technology based. In fact, in China, their pilot program, at least at the primary level, is not going to be distributed ledger based. In the US, it's unclear what the pilot program exactly will be, but the US does seem to be experimenting with a DLT-based hypothetical coin. And then finally, supply. Most fiat systems are fiat, so they are not based on an underlying commodity. They are not fixed in supply for a lot of reasons, whereas many cryptocurrencies are fixed in part to prove value, inherent value, by creating scarcity. So next slide, we can finish up with just some high-level considerations of, you know, what is the state of the digital dollar and what are some policy considerations. In August, Governor Brainard of the Federal Reserve revealed that the Fed has actually been experimenting internally with a DLT-based currency for the last few years, and they are now ready to start working with MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, on what they call a hypothetical digital dollar. The Fed has made clear that they are not rolling out a prototype, so they are not engaging in, you know, a digital dollar that will be unveiled sometime soon. Rather, they are testing a digital dollar internally to see what the operational risks are, to see things like resiliency, latency, cybersecurity, as well as just feasibility. This will be a multi-year project. And it is meant to see ultimately if a digital dollar could be used as a complement to payment options. The Fed has stressed that they are not looking to replace payment options, in part because they are literally trying to pull out the FedNow system by 2024. So they are not looking to replace that existing work, but to supplement it. Next slide, I'll finish up with some high-level policy considerations. For any central bank, what they're all talking about, what they're all concerned about are creating a system that is efficient, that is fast, a payment system that has high latency with the Fed as the direct problem for consumers, I think it's create a lot of political problems. It's one thing for consumers to have concerns with their bank or their payment processor, or whatever counterparty they're using for payments. But if the Fed were to create a digital dollar and digital wallet, and that would be a system that is slow or that doesn't work well, I think there'd be a big political backlash. So looking at those considerations, looking at cybersecurity concerns, data security, privacy, it's very important that whatever system is created has high integrity, so it can't be hacked or fraud can be detected very quickly. Of course, concerns about privacy and censorship as we continue to move to the Internet of Value, where information and value is moving at the same time. Concerns about censorship and, you know, government's ability to look into our transaction history will be paramount. As well as things that Judy talked about, financial inclusion. So the opportunity to maybe reduce account fees, you know, if digital accounts by retail, you know, by consumers are held at the retail level with Fed banks directly, as opposed to commercial banks, the ability to remove overdraft fees and minimum balances and other features that are considered to be barriers to entry. But finally, financial stability and financial crime. The bigger role that the Fed takes in the digital currency, the closer they get to being with the consumer directly, the bigger burden they're going to share for tracking down, monitoring, and preventing financial crime like money laundering, like illicit finance and trafficking, and ensuring that a digital dollar is able to work smoothly so that payment flows are not interrupted, particularly if a digital dollar is made programmable for other financial markets. If you have a problem with the dollar at the base level, you're going to have a huge problem with settlements in, you know, commodities, derivatives, securities, and other capital placement. So with that, I will turn it over to Ken to talk about GMO's stablecoin use cases that they're seeing and really the value that can be added with these types of products.
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to this panel, Judy, and the team. I'll be fairly quickly with the slides so I can take as many questions as possible. I can just get started.
You need the Stephanie, the slides now from the GMO, you had them earlier.
Yeah, so I'll just get started. But so GMO Internet Group is a Japanese publicly traded IT and financial company operating since 1991. And we currently have about 141 group companies, with about 30 of them operating outside of Japan. As you can see, our core business is the internet infrastructure business, but we've also been offering financial services for over a decade. We have a Japanese FSA-regulated internet bank, a crypto exchange, FX trading platform, which have done the largest trading volume globally for the past 7 years, and the largest payment gateway provider in Japan. So we're currently in the final phase of the application process with the New York Department of Financial Services to establish a New York trust company to issue stablecoins. Next slide, please. So with a strong expertise in the internet and financial services, we're bringing to the market the first regulated JPY-backed stablecoin, along with a new trusted USD-backed stablecoin upon approval of the application. So these are a few characteristics of our stablecoin, GEN and ZUSD. So these are products we're coming out of the gate with, but we consider ourselves to be a technology company with a goal of mainstreaming digital assets by bridging crypto ecosystem and traditional finance. Both stablecoins are ERC-20 tokens running on top of Ethereum blockchain, which is a public blockchain with that's most widely used protocol for stablecoins and other digital tokens. They're both 100% backed by fiat currencies held in a segregated FDIC-insured bank account, and we'll also be issuing a third-party attestation report to provide transparency. So here, what we're trying to do is, so far, Tether USDT is the most widely used stablecoin in the market, but we're trying to be the opposite of Tether, where we provide transparency, make sure that everyone understands that it's 100% backed by actual fiat currencies. So these tokens, these two stable coins will be available on multiple exchanges, both retail and institutionals. So they will be highly liquid. JPY stablecoin, I think, particularly interesting because US dollar and JPY FX trading pair has the second largest volume globally, and our FX arm alone settles $1 trillion on a monthly basis. So this could be an interesting opportunity for many crypto exchanges because they can easily offer USD-JPY trade pair utilizing stablecoins. And I'm already hearing from a few of the credible exchanges trying to capture these audiences. That, in a nutshell, is who we are and what we're working on. Happy to take any questions.
Ken, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for those presentations. Sorry, I had to take myself off mute. I do have a few questions. And, I don't know where to start because there's a lot here. But I will start off as kind of what are, Ken, if you could talk a little bit more about some of the use cases short term and long term when it comes to GMO's products.
Sure. So given the fact that we have multiple businesses in the financial space, we have a vision of seamlessly integrating our stablecoin to our existing businesses as part of our mid to long-term strategy. This, of course, includes utilizing stablecoin to move money around between the 140 group companies that we have. And speaking of immediate use cases, as you may already be aware of, is obviously the settlement and cross-border remittance associated with digital asset trading activities. There's many traders, both institutional and retail, capturing arbitrage opportunities between different exchanges across the globe. So there's actually quite a lot of activities going on behind the scene, such as rebalancing of different fiat currencies in their banks, rebalancing digital asset portfolios, and so on. Also getting physical JPY out of Japan for any digital asset or crypto-related companies are very challenging given the low risk tolerance of the local banks. So JPY stablecoin can serve these audiences as well.
And my next question is to you and Judy, but whoever you decides to take it first, because Judy's always got her ear to the ground. What's the drivers for this market? What's really going to push this market even closer to the mainstream? I know there's been a lot of growth over the last 5 years, but there's still a lot of growth left to take place. So what's really going to move this market?
I'd love to hear thoughts of the other panelists. I think the thing that came clearest through to me was the difficulty of getting payments to the unbanked during our ongoing COVID crisis, and the realization that the current rails just aren't working for enough people, and these products are so much more stable, so much more secure, and so much quicker. To me, that's really what's going to push adoption, not necessarily by the guy in the street, but by the local payment networks, the local remittance companies. I think you're going to see more and more interest on how to make payments faster and while keeping them secure and safe.
And there, many parts of the presentation touched on this, but I'd like to take a second to go a little bit deeper. What are the biggest hurdles here for adoption? Is it regulation? Is it something else? Is it, the technology still has some room to grow to come around and be useful to consumers? What are the biggest challenges facing this market?
One of the challenges, and I'm going to let the others speak too, but one of the big challenges is the lack of knowledge and understanding about this by regulators in particular. I think too many of them still look at anything that's DLT related or virtual or digital assets as they immediately think of the dark web and criminal activity and don't see immediately how it can be used for good. And those of us who are old enough to remember the early days of the internet no one wanted to touch the internet because it was like all porn and all criminal. And then suddenly, and now we can't live without it. So I do think that there is a huge learning curve for the public and for our legislators and regulators.
Do you want to pause just to remind people online and attending that you should feel free to ask a question. If it's okay, we did receive one question, and I will kick it off and let you guys decide who should take it first. But since the stable coins varies in levels of stability, what will be the minimum required to consider a digital coin in the category of a stable coin and be considered acceptable for government use?
I'd like to have Jeremy or Ken talk to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll attempt to talk to it. I unfortunately don't think there's a really clear answer. I mean, part of it comes that there's not really a universal definition of a stable coin yet. And so I think to me, the key asset of a stable coin is that it's just pegged to a particular asset or a pool of assets. It's not necessarily that there's a level of variance that it can or can't have to make it a stable coin. It's that it is at least pegged to something to back it. At least I'm not aware of any kind of someone that's come up with a definition of what variance is permissible to be labeled a stable coin or not.
I'll just pause real quickly to see if anyone else has a question. If you do, feel free to put it in the Q&A box down below. But I'm going to probably ask the toughest question that we have that's probably top of mind here for lots of people, which is, what are the challenges to get people to move away from cash? All of us use cash at some level in our lives, even for small dollar purchases. We see the challenge of moving away from cash, and COVID has sped that up a little bit. But what is the how are you going to move people from cash or using cash to electronic payments and get to stable coins?
My first thoughts in response to that is, like, do we really need to move people away from cash? I'm a full believer that CBDCs, stable coins, should be an additional payment mechanism. But I do think that people who want to use cash should be able to use cash. I'm a person who's a little bit wary because of the fact that especially blockchain related, or, you know, anything on the payment finance system, there you lose so much privacy that I'm a little bit wary about the thought of eliminating cash altogether. But I do think people will start picking and choosing very carefully when they use cash. I know I, for one, use cash less and less than what I used to back in the day. It is pretty unusual to use it, but I don't know whether I would espouse eliminating all cash.
And if I could go back to Ken for a second, I do want to ask, you know, what are your thoughts about why no one has issued a JPY-backed stable coin yet?
Sure. I think there's two major hurdles. Number one is that the Japanese regulator, they haven't really defined what type of asset stable coin will fit into. So the regulation is still unclear. Number two, there's no Japanese banks that's willing to work with digital assets or crypto-related companies. And it's near impossible to find a partner to hold the underlying fiat currency. There's actually three. JPY has a negative yield associated. So essentially, the more stablecoin you issue, the more money you lose. So the company, you know, that's going to be issuing the JPY-backed stablecoin will need a fairly large balance sheet to cover the cost. So therefore, we took the approach of launching in New York because NYDFS has been regulating stablecoin for 2+ years and offer clear guidance. U.S. banks are more open to working with digital assets companies. So we hold our own reserves in FDIC-insured U.S. banks. And, you know, given the fact that we're part of the publicly traded company with a big balance sheet, we can definitely cover the negative yield cost.
I do want to move back to consumers, and I've got two questions, and I just want to pause one more time to remind everyone, if you have a question, feel free to submit it through the Q&A chat. But this might go to Dan or Jeremy in terms of consumers. Is there a difference as far as the consumer is concerned between a stablecoin and a kind of centrally backed currency, electronic currency, or what will be, you know, if I'm the consumer looking into these products, what's the difference as far as I'm concerned?
Yeah. I'll offer some initial thoughts and then Dan, obviously feel free to add, but I think kind of going along with what Judy said earlier, I think just consume awareness at any level, a regulatory level is important for adoption of these, but also at the consumer level, I think even more so. I mean, I don't think everyday consumers really understand crypto at all, let alone what a stablecoin is or a CBDC. And so I think one is just consumer understanding of what this is. And I think to be able to explain that a stablecoin doesn't have the scary aspects of a normal cryptocurrency that can fluctuate all the time will help a consumer kind of get more at ease with using it. And I think merchants have a role to play here as well. I mean, the use cases where we've seen some stablecoins really be used a lot kind of in e-commerce, the merchants have also really pushed this to consumers because of the lower processing costs that both parties benefit from. As between a stablecoin or a CBDC, I mean, this is purely guessing. I mean, I would think a consumer that doesn't know a lot of the difference, they would say, oh, the government is behind this. Like maybe they would take more comfort in that than, oh, I don't know what this Facebook money is, and I don't know if I can trust Facebook. You know, I my knee-jerk reaction is they would think they would trust the CBDC a bit more out of the gate.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would add that they can serve very different purposes, right? If we had a digital dollar, I mean, you would use it for what we do now with like mobile banking, right? Making transfers with things like Venmo or Zelle and other providers and, you know, typical payments at the consumer level, Starbucks. But a digital dollar would not be a useful hedge for any kind of volatility within crypto assets. Or at least at the beginning, it wouldn't be as good a hedge as a stablecoin. So for instance, if you are a developer on Ethereum and you want to protect your Ether supply, which you need for your company, I would want a stablecoin that's, you know, better paired with ETH, whereas digital dollar can easily fluctuate based on demand against ETH, just as any other fiat currency would. So you would minimize your transaction costs and your volatility with those kind of coins. And similarly too, if you wanted to buy Bitcoin or any other crypto asset, whether it be, a quote unquote utility token or whether it be a store of value or whether it's in and of itself meant to be, you know, a unique asset. So something like a digital representation of art, you know, on blockchain, I think a stablecoin would be a much more useful tool in that part of the, you know, internet of value than a digital dollar.
Now we have 5 minutes left, and this question, my next question, could be a presentation for itself, by itself. And this is in regards to Facebook and Libra and I guess Novi or whatever it is, the project is called today. And Dan, I think it was you who mentioned that it's not even a product, it's a concept still. Right. And you know, what is there to fear if you're a regulator? And we all know that something different and new, regulators often are a step behind. They need a moment to pause and dig deeper. And the rest of us need to catch up as well. But what should, you know, I guess regulators be thinking about, and what are they scared of when it comes to Libra, since it is still in quote unquote concept mode?
I mean, I'll start. I think especially when you think about legislators, I think the difference with the Libra concept is, unlike some other stable coins or cryptocurrencies, it doesn't want to just be a separate thing. It wants to be treated as a currency in itself. And so you know, the theory being that if Libra catches on, then it will displace the dollar. And that concern isn't raised as much with other stable coins or cryptocurrencies. So, you know, for instance, I think the legislator's big concern and Libra's goal is if you spend mostly dollars in your everyday and Libra is always going up and down against the dollar, that will be annoying and you won't want Libra. But if you mostly spend Libras, for instance, if you could transact a lot of stuff online, or, you know, buy and sell on Facebook's marketplace, then that dynamic reverses. The dollar or whatever currency will be going up and down against the Libra, and that will be annoying. And so you'll want more Libra because that will seem like the more stable one. And the more and more you buy online, everything is priced in Libra, and therefore you'll end up living your life spending Libra and not whatever the national currency is. And I think that is what a lot of legislators really feel, that their concern is that they're losing control and displacing their national currency. And I think Dan mentioned this, you know, I think the stable coins and especially the Libra concept is what really has spurred the development of CBDCs almost as like a defense, because they see this as something that they don't want to happen.
I also think there is some pushback just based on the perceived arrogance of Facebook. I actually had a chance, I was listening to a couple of regulators talking, and they were saying, you know, can you believe they came up with this whole concept without talking to a single regulator first? They didn't actually go in and, you know, I can tell you, especially in Europe, having worked out of our London office for a couple of years, they're very just distrustful of Facebook, unfortunately. I mean, if it had come from another source, it might have been welcomed a little more than it was.
Yeah, and I'll just add quickly to that, at least in the States, much of the concern is over privacy and data security. And as Judy said, you know, Facebook has had a pretty mixed record on both of those things, and that gives a lot of politicians and regulators heartburn. The Federal Reserve has said on multiple occasions that there is no one federal regulator who has plenary power over our payment system. I mean, the Fed is the primary federal regulator, and at the state level, it's, you know, divisions of banking or securities, whoever controls money transmission, licenses. But it gives them concern that they will not be able to see something like Libra at every point of the transaction regulated if they need to step in for things like weak BSA, AML compliance, weak fraud issues, weak consumer protections. So they're very wary of a system becoming as popular as Jeremy mentioned, that may not have the privacy and data security controls that they want and doesn't have as strong anti-money laundering, illicit finance procedures in place, and the inability to really crack down if they feel they need to.
Now it is just almost 2:00. We have one more question, if I can ask it of Jeremy real quickly, just to go into overtime here before we break. Can you elaborate on, Jeremy, I guess this is the question, Jeremy mentioned a concern of Libra displacing the national currency. Would that not be the point of all digital currency, or could you elaborate on how digital currency could work alongside national currency?
Yeah, I think the difference, at least certainly from a legislator's perspective, between kind of Libra and something, for instance, Tether, so the most widely used stablecoin. So, you know, Tether's appeal is that you can at any point redeem it for real world dollars. And I think the thought, you know, no one thinks you're going to go to the grocery store and use Tether to buy groceries. They expect that you can hold Tether, but you're going to redeem that and get dollars, and that's how you're going to go spend at the grocery store. But Libra's proposition is different, and it's, I think, more scary to regulators because it has the Facebook platform. Everyone has Facebook, and Facebook has a marketplace. And so in one fell swoop if this came to fruition, you know, suddenly there is an international marketplace for this one currency that other stable coins really don't have or even present themselves as claiming. You know, their reason for existence is we're backed by the euro or the dollar, and you can convert into dollar at any time. That is not the proposition that Libra is pushing forward.
would agree with that. I do think that the other half of that question is there, can they work together? And I do think people see more than one payment product in your wallet. And I think that there's just a concern that Facebook is so big and it covers merchant side as well as the spend side. It's global, that somehow it was the only payment product in your wallet, and that it might, you know, push out the others. I think that's part of the concern.
Judy, that's the last word. I do want to thank you, Judy, Dan, Jeremy, and Ken for being with us this afternoon. I want to thank our attendees. We do have one more presentation that's going to start, I believe, at 2:30. So we have to jump off and get ready for that. But thank you, everyone. If anyone has any questions after today for Judy and her colleagues and Ken, please let us know. We'd be happy to pass it on. But thank you again. We'll talk to you. We'll continue this conversation, I should say, later this year as the market continues to change. So thank you. We'll see you in a little bit, everyone. We'll see you in about 30 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.